Hello and welcome to this episode of the Think Wildlife podcast. Today, I speak to Sanjay Gupi, who is a scientist at the Nature Conservation Foundation. He is one of the leading experts on tiger and leopard conservation in India. Over the last few decades, he has worked extensively on mitigating tiger and leopard conflict in the Western Ghats, while also trying to minimize the impacts of roads on large mammal conservation. He also led to the formation of a wildlife sanctuary in Chamarajanagar district of Karnataka. This is the Kaveri Wildlife Sanctuary. He is the author of various conservation books, predominantly focusing on leopard and tiger conservation. The links to these books are in the description below. Do check them out. And if you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe and share. Welcome, Sanjay, to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on here today.
Thank you, Anish. It's a pleasure to talk to you as well.
What got you interested in conservation?
See, during my high school days, I used to be a part of the scouting movement. And scouting movement is a lot about outdoors. So we learned a lot about nature. We learned about camping. And from that, I graduated into doing bird watching. And from there, into large mammals. And I once went on a trip to Nagarhole National Park in Karnataka. It's one of the most beautiful places with large mammals. And then that got me hooked on to working on large mammal conservation.
Much of your work has revolved around studying and mitigating human-wildlife conflict in the Western Ghats. So what makes this region so prone to human-wildlife conflict?
See, after the implementation of the Wildlife Protection Act 1972, several wildlife species have bounced back in India. Species like the tiger, the elephant, the leopard, and many other species have come back. And some of them actually from the brink of extinction, if you look at Asiatic lions in Gujarat. So as wildlife population increases, along with that human population increases, the natural habitats of wildlife has been coming down. So that's one of the reasons. But human-wildlife conflict is a very complex subject. So you can't really pinpoint on one issue or one cause which leads to conflict. But certainly high human population, high wildlife numbers, and smaller natural habitats can lead to conflict in areas like the Western Ghats and generally in India.
You extensively studied the patterns and correlates of human-elephant conflict in the Western Ghats. What were your key findings from here?
One important point is the general perception or the general myth that elephant conflict increases because there's less water or less fodder available within the natural habitats. I think conflict occurs during certain periodic times, like, you know, post-monsoon when crops like paddy or ragi millet, they all start ripening. And that's when the conflict increases with elephants. So one important thing was to burst this myth that there's no fodder or water in the forest, hence elephants come out and raid crops. And the second thing is also about how we are managing natural habitats of elephants. You know, there's extensive changes and modifications made to elephant habitats, increase in surface water availability, which perhaps is reducing natural mortality of young animals, weak animals, unfit animals, and also perhaps stop movement patterns of these large pachyderms across the landscape. I think these are very important to understand that human-wildlife conflict, or specifically human-elephant conflict, requires a lot more nuanced understanding to mitigate rather than very naive saying like there is less fodder and water in the forest.
So my next question is that at your organization, you are working extensively to mitigate human-wildlife conflict in Kaveri Wildlife Sanctuary and Male Mateshwara Hills Tiger Reserve. So talk a bit about your work in this region.
MMLs is not a tiger reserve. It's also a wildlife sanctuary. So we started working in this landscape for almost 1.5 decades ago when we were first involved in gazettement of MM Hills Wildlife Sanctuary, but also expansion of Kaveri Wildlife Sanctuary. And then we started collecting baseline information of wildlife presence and also wildlife population and abundance of large carnivores and large prey species. From that, we also started working on working with communities on mitigating issues like reduction of dependence on forests for firewood collection, and the same species which were collected for fire as firewood were also important fodder species for elephants and other large prey species in that landscape. And it also leads to conflict because people have to go into forests, they come in contact with large animals which are conflict prone, like sloth bear, leopards, tiger, elephants. So that's when we also started this work on providing alternatives to firewood. But we also tried other models of mitigating human-wildlife conflict, like setting up community solar fences for people's croplands, which worked very successfully, in fact. And we continue to work on some of the initiatives we have started in this landscape.
So what are some of the key challenges to mitigating human-wildlife conflict in these regions?
As I said earlier, you know, human-wildlife conflict is a combination of several issues. So there is a severe lack of understanding of how do we mitigate conflict or even bring it down to tolerable limits amongst everyone, actually, amongst several stakeholders, including the forest department, the communities, the farmers, and many others. And that, I feel, is the biggest challenge, that bringing up that awareness about what could be the possible solution is something we are trying to work on, but it's going to take a long time to change perceptions of people.
Species you have worked most with are leopards. So these cats are known to exist in areas with high human densities. Why is this the case and how do they adapt to such landscapes?
Leopards, because of their body size and their adaptability and flexibility to survive on a wide variety of prey. You know, research shows leopards consume about 110 species of mammals. And if it birds and reptiles are all in and fishes are all included in the menu, it crosses over 200 species on its menu card. So this particular biological or ecological aspect of the species makes it adaptable even in areas with high human densities. But it's not as rosy as we say that leopards survive in amidst high human densities. They also have a huge cost when the human density increases in the area or in the if they survive in areas that have high human densities. Our research clearly shows that leopards suffer a lot of mortality due to snaring when human population goes beyond about 200 people per square kilometers. Our research also shows high levels of mortality because of vehicular traffic, leopards falling into wells, and other these kinds of causes. Hence, leopards are, though they survive in high human density areas, they also survive at a big cost, like high levels of mortality.
India only has 5% of her land in protected areas, which is far less than our neighbors such as China and Nepal. So why is this the case? And do you think that increasing the area under the protected area network will be a viable solution to minimize human-wildlife conflict?
It's one of the solutions, but it's not the sole solution. But we certainly need more land under protected area network. We need more land under various kinds of habitats like grasslands, scrub land, marine protected areas. Of course, there are different ways of how these habitats have to be managed, even if they are notified as a protected area. But like land tenure is a very important issue in human communities for agriculture, for human settlements, it's also very important for long-term sustenance and conservation of wildlife species. Hence, I feel it's very important that more and more land is secured, of course, in a manner which is plausible and also amenable for both people and wildlife. We certainly need to increase our protected area network in the country of India.
As you mentioned earlier, that many of our megafauna species are recovering. So, how do you think in the long run we can minimize human wildlife conflict across the country by the rampant economic development?
See, there are some species which survive very well with humans. You know, it could be sparrows, it could be some species of mammals, some species of reptiles, some species of fishes. But there are some species of wildlife which will lead to conflict, you know. So one of the things, key things, is to zone our areas where people survive and where priority should be given to wildlife conservation and where priority should be given to development, infrastructure development. And in the areas where there should be a coexistence between people and wildlife, we certainly need a lot more mitigation measures, which are currently absent, a lot more awareness. And as India progresses economically, we are going to be less and less tolerant about nature, especially about species that are conflict prone. So you can't, we can't just swim in the past glory that, you know, coexistence is all good and happy and hunky-dory. We certainly, things are changing, the society is changing, economy is changing, culture is changing. With all this, the attitude towards wildlife is also changing. And that's a very key thing we need to keep in mind when we are planning for conserving certain wildlife species.
On that note, has there been any positive case of human wildlife coexistence, especially in the Western Ghats?
See, all across the country, people certainly have a soft corner for wildlife, but when it starts impacting their livelihoods, when it starts impacting their lives, people become less tolerant then. And it is normally this tolerance or acceptance is wrongly projected as coexistence because people are coexisting at a huge cost. And this existence model has to be propagated by people who suffer the cost of conservation. It should be the people who want to live with wildlife who need to promote it, and should not be done by academicians. I think it's coming from the wrong mouth altogether. So if people who are actually living with tigers and elephants and leopards and wild pigs and bonnet macaws that cause a huge impact on their day-to-day lives, and even after that, if they say that they are happy to coexist, then I think it's a true model of coexistence. Otherwise, people continue to suffer. On the other hand, wildlife continues to suffer. I'll give you a classic example in the state of Karnataka, in the Western Ghats, in a district called Hasan. It's again, you know, it's promoted as human-elephant coexistence, but every day elephants are being killed. Elephants are being captured and translocated. But how can we call that as coexistence when one of the parties or one of the important stakeholders, which in this case is elephants, continue to suffer and continue to lose their numbers? Along with their numbers, their natural habitats are also getting lost on a daily basis. That I don't think is true model for coexistence. True model of coexistence should be about people happily accepting conflict-prone species, and there's a via media, and both are not losing below certain tolerable limits.
You also have worked extensively to mitigate the impacts of roads on wildlife. So, beyond the obvious increase in road mortality, what other impacts do roads have on wildlife?
See, roads are a very important part of our economic development and for movement of goods and passengers. But we need to clearly see where more and more roads can come up, because India certainly needs more and more roads. And some of the highest road development is going to happen in the BRICS countries in the future, like Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And I think it's about 50% of the world's road network is going to come up in these five countries in the next 20 years or so. Hence, we have to be very clear where we are going to have these roads coming up. We can't have roads running around all across important biodiversity areas or important wildlife habitats. So in such cases, we need to reroute, and we need to ensure that it's avoided. And we develop such road infrastructure outside the protected area network or in outside areas where which have key important key or important natural habitats for wildlife. It could be grasslands, it could be forests, it could be swamps, it could be wetlands, it could be anything. But we need to ensure that biodiversity also get equal importance when we are talking about infrastructure development. And our models in Karnataka has certainly been seen as a very important foot forward to ensure that there is sustainability between both wildlife conservation and development. And these models have been implemented in other states now, and I'm extremely happy that we are able to set up such initiatives in the state of Karnataka.
Talk a bit about your paper where you studied the impacts of vehicular traffic on large mammals in southern India.
See, it was perhaps one of the first studies in India which looked at how large mammals are impacted by vehicular traffic, but also compared roads with vehicular traffic, roads with or stretches of the road which had vehicular traffic only during the daytime, and vehicular traffic and road stretches which had vehicular traffic 24 hours of the day. So it clearly provided us inputs like how roads impact large mammal usage of highways. It clearly showed some of the commensal species, some of the generalists like jungle cat, were not highly impacted by traffic movement, but species like dholes or tigers or elephants were certainly impacted by vehicular traffic movement. So this kind of data was extremely important to provide alternative solutions to the government. So we can keep complaining about the impacts infrastructure development or humans have on wildlife conservation or on large mammals. But if we don't go with alternatives, if we don't go with solutions, most policymakers are going to ignore us. That's the biggest mistake we do as conservationists and ecologists, that is that we just complain, but we don't go with alternatives and work with the system to bring in on-ground changes.
So you were involved with a campaign which aimed to ban vehicular traffic at night hours in Bandipur and Nagarholi National Park. So talk a bit about this campaign.
Oh, it was a very long drawn campaign. It was not just about like blaming the system. As you would have seen, or if you have read some of the book chapters I've written on these campaigns, it was working with the existing system. It was working with the media. It was working with conservationists. It was working with bureaucrats. It was about working with political leaders, everything together. So I think it was an ideal model where even in this era of importance for economic development, we were able to succeed to convince the system that, you know, closing vehicular traffic at night times in these critical tiger reserves was extremely important. But we also ensured that we worked with the government to develop alternatives, like alternative roads for Bandipur, alternate road for the Mysore Manantwadi road that was passing through the Nagarhole Tiger Reserve. That alternative road not only ensured that there was less impact on wildlife, but also gave connectivity to 23 villages which were outside the tiger reserve where the new road was built. And for the first time in the history of the country, the government invested 18 crores, 18 Indian rupees, 18 crores Indian rupees on developing that alternative road outside the tiger reserve. That is what is very important to demonstrate, and also to show that all these viable solutions exist, but we need to go and demonstrate it to the government. We need to work with them to get those alternative solutions implemented.
So, what are some of the other works which you and your organizations is involved with to mitigate the impacts of roads on wildlife?
See, we have identified and proposed to the government a few roads or highways within the state of Karnataka which can be avoided, which already have alternatives. And if there are no alternatives at all, is then we have to see if mitigation measures work on such stretches of roads. You know, though that's very important, you know, to provide those kinds of policy inputs to the government. And also, as we have already shown with models within the same state, such kind of activities and initiatives can be implemented in these new areas as well.
So one of your most prominent achievements is the establishment of MM Hills Wildlife Sanctuary in 2013. So how did this happen?
That's a good question and also a very important question. MM Hills was ravaged by granite quarrying for a very long time. Despite that, there was high potential for wildlife recovery. The second biggest problem in that landscape was the existence of a bandit called Veerappan, who reigned that area, including Cauvery Wildlife Sanctuary and parts of BR Hills, for a very long time. So Veerappan's presence in that area ensured that no conservation activity could have been taken up in that landscape till 2005. After his death, conservation started to kick into those areas. And one of the things we saw was that this about 900 square kilometers of land, which was designated as reserve forest, had huge potential to recover large mammals. And it was a key link between Cauvery Wildlife Sanctuary and BRT Tiger Reserve. Hence, we worked with the government, convinced the bureaucrats, and thanks to people like Mr. B.K. Singh, Mr. Deepak Sharma, Mr. R. Sridhar, who were all part of the Forest Department at that point of time, or even Mr. Javed Mumtaz and Mr. Vasant Reddy, we were able to get it notified as a protected area in 2013. And today we clearly see a recovery of a certain wildlife species in that area. It's also acting as a key sink area for tigers coming from Satyamangalam Tiger Reserve and BRT Tiger Reserves.
So, what have been some of the most prominent challenges and lessons from your conservation career?
Conservation is not a project, and unlike a lot of organizations and individuals think conservation as a project, we need to think of it as a lifetime commitment, a long-term commitment to a landscape and to species. People hop and jump around from one landscape to another landscape depending upon various conveniences. I don't think that is going to make an impact in the longer term if you just because you change your importance about a landscape or species. So it's very important that you have a long-term commitment for a landscape or even for a species and work on it by understanding the larger socio-political and economic aspects of conservation. And very importantly, communication. Outreach and communication is a very important and large chunk of conservation work we do. That is because it has shown utmost results for conservation, more than even science, actually. Science, in my opinion, wildlife conservation is 90% out communication and 10% science.
What have been some of the most memorable moments from your conservation career?
Every day is a memorable moment because every day some of the other interesting and exciting things keep happening in conservation. But of course, there are some outliers, like seeing a tiger pug mark in Cauvery Wildlife Sanctuary after we started working, and those areas which were earlier not gazetted as protected areas, you suddenly see tiger pug marks in that area where tiger has been expanding into these new territories, or a tiger which was born in Bandipur Tiger Reserve has now established itself in Cauvery Wildlife Sanctuary, walking we don't know how long and for how far, but it clearly shows Cauvery and MM Hills are all now providing space for young transient tigers which come and settle down in those landscapes. So these are some of the best moments I can think of from my wildlife career.
So, what would be your advice to people who are looking for a career in wildlife conservation?
One is you certainly need commitment. You need long-term commitment. Don't look at it as a profession. Look at it as a lifetime commitment to wildlife conservation. So if you just look at it as a career, profession, you don't put your heart and soul into it. You may still do it, but there is always a line one would draw, thinking, "Oh, it's just a profession. I can do something else, or I don't have to put in so much of efforts into it." So your commitment has to come from your belly. It has to come from your heart. And what I would suggest is, if you're, for example, if you're from Assam or if you're from Rajasthan or if you're from Tamil Nadu, the biggest contribution can be made if you work in your local area, because you know the language, you know the culture, you know how various things work in the society. So my serious advice to young conservationists is, do conservation, with your heart, not just with your mind. That's very important that you need to, your career has to be driven by passion, not just by career goals like I want to achieve a PhD or I want to publish these papers in the next few years, either in Nature or in Science. Those are all wonderful goals, but I think wildlife needs a lot more than that.
So that was a fun question I had for you. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure, Anish. All the very best for Think Wildlife Podcast.